magic lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses through his transformational training program.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and today I'm joined here with my lovely wife Robin.
Hi everybody.
And we are so excited to announce that the Journey On podcast has received over 1 million downloads. So this is going to be our 1 million download episode. So I'll give you a few stats on the podcast. We've had 66 episodes so far, and our first one was July 31st, 2020, and I think that was about the same time that everybody else decided a podcast might be a good idea too, because we all realize we're going to be stuck at home for a while.
Also, right now is a good time to kind of explain how the whole thing got started, and I want to say thank you, Warwick, publicly for not listening to my suggestion about what the podcast should be, because I don't think we would have a million downloads if you did what I suggested. So my suggestion was to do kind of a call-in show where people called in with their questions about their horses and Warwick answered their questions. Well, as avid listeners to the podcast, you will know that that is not what the podcast is, and it's taken a whole different turn. And I know better now to defer to Warwick for content, because he just seems to know what to put out there, and it resonates with the most people. So good job, babe. So what we decided to do for this special episode that is celebrating our 1 million downloads is we're going to pull our most memorable pieces from the different podcast guests, like the things that really resonated with us, that really hit us, that really made us go, aha, okay. And hopefully they will resonate with you also. And if you haven't listened to the whole podcast that they are, that they come from, we hope that you'll go back and listen to those and you can get the full context if we haven't provided that for you.
When we first started doing the podcast, the first episode I did was called Changes, and it was basically me just talking about how I've changed the way I do things with horses in the last 5 or 6 years, and, you know, that goes on to changing how I view the world. The second episode was once again me on here, and it was about the science of connection. It was just explaining more about how the connection stuff works with the horses and some of the science behind it, polyvagal theory, things like that. Then I did one on books that have influenced me, so influential books. And then Robin joined me and we talked about our trip to the World Equestrian Games and everything leading up to it. The next episode, my son Tyler came on and we talked about our trip to Mongolia, riding camels across the Gobi Desert. The seventh episode was the Journey On Questions, and I had planned to ask a number of different questions of the guests. And so I did a whole podcast where I answered the questions myself. But then episode number 8 was a conversation with Jane Pike. And when we first decided to rehash some of our highlights from the podcast, the first thing that jumped to my mind was my conversation with Jane. And, you know, wanting to have guests on here, I thought the guests were going to be sharing ideas with our listeners, but I didn't realize I was going to get therapisted on my own podcast. And it happened more than once, but this was the first time. And it was when I asked Jane one of the podcast questions, which is, what is the most worthwhile thing you've put your time into?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the most worthwhile things that you can put your time into is to really understanding yourself. I know that seems very glib and kind of a little bit idealistic, but I would say the biggest game changer for me of late as well, but also cumulatively leading up to this point, has been really taking the time to try and understand how I tick and also how our nervous system functions. That has been such a game changer for me. And when I really understood that, it's really empowering, because you start to understand what your body is doing to keep you safe and what your body is doing in response to different things that are coming your way. And it's very easy to get into this mode of operating, and I certainly see it all the time, of thinking that there's something wrong with you, you know, like, what's wrong with me? Why do I keep doing this? Or why did this happen? Or you know, I know that I want this thing to happen, and yet this is all the time where I seem to take myself. Why does that happen? And so when you can understand more about that side of things, you can liberate yourself from this idea that you're somehow a dysfunctional model and start to work with better understandings that allow you to move in a direction. And I wouldn't say move in an easier direction, because I don't necessarily think that having that kind of knowledge makes things easier as such, but it certainly makes you more aware, and it certainly makes you more alive, and it certainly makes you more in life. And being in life isn't necessarily the easy option, but it's the best one. That has been probably the most profound piece. And I think just of late, I love to see where it takes me, but just of late, I've had so much clarity around that. And I can see how all the different little pieces coming up to this point help to facilitate a really good understanding of those elements. Yeah.
Yeah, I love what you said in there about you get to the point where you understand there's not something wrong with you. And I think, like, for me personally, you know, because we all have that, what you call the itty bitty shitty committee, and I think some of us have it so much we don't even know we have one. You know, it's not like you have the good guy and then the shitty guy shows up. If you only have a shitty guy, you're going to contrast, you're going to black and white. You can't go, I know who's talking now. If you only have that one.
Yeah.
And I think along with that comes a lot of, you know, self-judgment about who you are, and then, or who you think you are. And then when you start to understand what you were talking about, understand why you are the way you are, and the way you are is perfectly normal for either what's happened to you or how your nervous system is wired because of what's happened to you, or even how your nervous system is working because of what chemicals you have in your brain at the time, you know, I like all that stuff. Like because, you know, I'm a big fan of Brené Brown, when she talks about, you know, like the difference between guilt and shame and being able to reframe things as they come up. And, you know, I think you've been on that journey a whole lot longer than me, but just starting on it's like, like you said, it's not easy. It's not easier, but it's better.
Yeah, it is. And it also just allows me, or has allowed me, to have so much compassion for myself and for other people. And also this incredible sense of wonderment, I think, in that, like, the stories that I get through my work just blow me away. I think, how does someone survive that? You know, like, here I am, I'm working with horses, I'm working with riders. The stories I get are so far beyond that. You know, like, we're talking about childhood trauma, abuse, different things that go on in life, where I think, like, to hold the email, even, you know, like, in terms of, like, hold space for the email takes a lot, let alone holding space for something like that in someone's life. And so what I've really understood is that all of these situations or learnings or understandings, I guess, that we might think of as not ideal, be that like shut down, be that the flight or fight response, be that freezing up, like, what a gift that is, that we are able to navigate situations in life that we don't have the resources at the time to be able to hold, and to have somewhere to go to be able to survive that. You know, like, what an amazing blessing that is, that we are able to do that. And what an incredible safety mechanism that is of the body to actually decide to keep you safe in that way. You know what I mean? Like, it is a beautiful thing. It really is a beautiful thing. And even like something like where I know that the way that I've had relationship with food in the past, for instance, has been something that I've beaten myself up about. And again, that was in my early 20s. And now I think, wow, I can see why that happened, or I can see why I responded in the way that I did, because that was my body's best attempt to keep me safe. And so if I approach my work and my life from that angle, I'm like, wow, this survival mechanism that we have is such a gift. But the transformation is that we just don't want to stay stuck there. You know, so we needed that we absolutely needed that and we're grateful for that. But now we recognize there's a place that we can move beyond that. And that's where we start to soften the edges of our resistance and flow in different ways.
You just changed my life. right then. I've never thought of it that way. I've never thought of, since I've discovered that I'm been shut down forever, I have never looked at it like, wow, so glad I had that.
Yeah, that's so amazing. Glad you had that. What a clever body, you know, like what a clever body. It was like, you know, little Warwick or big Warwick, this is too much for him. Where are we going to take him? What can we do right now to keep him safe? Let's just make it feel less, you know, or let's just distract him, or let's do something. And so if you can just think, this has been, it's a real, been very transformative for me in thinking that you're never trying to work against yourself. Not ever, not even if it feels like you are. There is always a higher purpose to your behavior. And that unconscious driver, that is always working in what it perceives to be your benefit. Sometimes it's not your benefit in terms of what is happening in the present moment, but that is only because the information that your brain or system has not been updated. As soon as you can update that information and go, actually, we recognize you're going into this default place. And we all have default places that we go to when we're under some kind of stress. But what if we can actually move in this way that I call embodied discernment, which is like, huh, I recognize that I'm dancing this line and there's this decision that I have to make between honoring what it is that's presenting and perhaps retreating, or recognizing that this is a habitual response of my system in response to stress. So how is it that I can just dive underneath or move horizontally or shift around it so that I can create a different experience in this same situation without overwhelming myself and feeling like I need to retreat or withdraw to a place that feels familiar and feels safe but isn't necessarily in my best interest now?
Well, yeah, you know, people that have listened to me a bit know that I'm very fond of the saying about you know, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And I just had a sliding door moment, a Bruce Willis Sixth Sense moment right then, to where I have never thought of it as, since I've identified, I've never thought of it as my friend.
Mm. Totally your friend. It was like scooping you up. Yeah. And it's the same for our horses. It feels like that is the safest option, right? This is the safest option if they've been in an abusive situation. And abusive can just be unintentional, you know, human relationships.
Yes. Yeah, so you don't have to be nasty to them at all.
Yeah, but
I
thank
think
goodness.
Humans too.
Yeah, so it's I think you just have to thank, those were the resources that you had and you used them and they got you through. And that's a beautiful thing. And so now I see that's honestly the position I come from, and it's switched everything around. I have, when I think of it like that, I have nothing but compassion.
You know, I'm a huge fan of the Wayne Dyer saying, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And that's really what happened there with Jane on that podcast, that really made me look at how my body reacted to things in the past completely differently.
And for me, you know, I've learned so much from Jane and all of the, about the nervous system. And what I think is just so fascinating is that, you know, your default was to shut down and my default is to be anxious. So, you know, I guess we balance each other out that way, but it is about self-compassion. And I think we both need to do a little bit more of that with ourselves. And I guess we can help each other do that.
Yeah, thanks, hon. That's a great suggestion, both on the helping ourselves and helping each other. So the next magic moment from the podcast, this one really stuck out in my mind, was when I spoke to Tanya Kindersley. So Tanya is an author and she's lives in Scotland, but she's British, so she's got this beautiful, educated British accent. And you know, because she's an author, she can write, but also she's got this, like I said, this amazing accent. And when I could listen to it, she could read me the phone book and I'd think it would sound amazing. But, you know, This magic moment you're about to listen to here came about when I asked Tanya to tell me, you know, basically, how did you get into horses? And the story itself is compelling. The way she says it is compelling. But like towards the end of this thing, she says some sayings that have now become part of our vocabulary, I think, or at least around our house. Have a listen to this. Do you want to, let's maybe back up a bit and tell us about your life with horses. You've always been around horses, haven't you?
I grew up with horses because my dad was a steeplechase jockey and then a racehorse trainer. So by the time I came along, he'd retired from riding and he was training horses. So thoroughbreds were pretty much probably my first memory was going out in the dawn. It was jump racing in England takes place mostly in the winter. So, you know, it would be pitch dark and freezing cold. And I just followed Dad out into the yard like a little puppy. And I remember pottering around in the stables. It was at that lovely moment you go into the stable and you turn the light on and there's that blinking as they wake up. And they were such gentle giants. And I just spend time with them and walk under their tummies and give them their feed. And that was my love of the thoroughbred right there. These just extraordinary athletes. And you think they're race fit. And yet they were the gentlest creatures I'd ever known. And then there was a lot of pony life and showing. And it was all very competitive. The pony yard was in competition with the racing yard. So if we won more stuff than they did, they'd all get really cross. It's really interesting to me now because that idea of winning has just completely gone. But so I was very competitive, very tough. My dad was very physically brave. There was a lot of premium on doing things that scared you and a lot of cross country, you know, all that kind of stuff. A huge amount of fun. And then my life completely changed and there were lots of divorces and not really a home for a long time. So I went away from horses and I became very urban. And the only connection I had with horses was I just watched the racing and have these wonderful memories of that extraordinary childhood. And then my dad died and that was really oceanic. It was a much bigger shock than I thought it would be. I just thought he'd run his race. He was 80 years old. He was ready to go. But it felt like the world had turned upside down. And I found it very hard to deal with. And I suddenly thought, about a year after he died, I thought, I know, I'll go back to horses and I'll get a thoroughbred and then I will have that precious memory with me and I'll be able to, I had this plan that I would ride out into the Scottish hills with carrying my dad with me and that I'd sing the Irish songs that he used to sing to me when I was a little girl sitting on his knee. And I just thought this was the best plan ever. And at the time, a friend of mine had a ex-racehorse who'd gone for polo and she was hopeless at polo and she'd been pretty bad at racing. And I happened to be staying with him and I told him all this and he said, oh, well, you know, take that red mare. So I did. And I thought, you know, I haven't had a horse for 30 years, but that's fine. I could sit on a horse before I could construct a sentence. It'll all come back. And I got her up to Scotland and she took one look at me and she literally shook her head. She started shaking her head so badly. I thought she had a brain tumor. I really did. And she didn't want to ride out into the hills. She didn't. She hated the woods. She had no interest in the songs. She didn't want to be part of my sentimental journey. So she started rearing and she had an incredible signature move, which was going downhill backwards at top speed. And she spooked at everything and she wouldn't walk over puddles. And I can feel it now as I'm telling you. I was in a place of such shame and such humiliation. I mean, talk about expectation management, that I'd had this whole dream and she just said no. And there was a night, and you know this story, I've told it a million times. It's my favorite story, really. I was sitting in my room in the shame, in the humiliation, literally crying tears of despair. And I Googled how to have a happy horse. And through a series of links, the internet took me to you. And I thought, oh, okay, this bloke sounds like he knows what he's talking about. Also, I love the fact that you were an Aussie, because I thought that I'm going to get no nonsense from this fella. He'll just, you know, that good old Aussie, no crap, let's just get stuff done. And that's what we did at the beginning, and suddenly we could get stuff done. She stopped rearing and she stopped reversing downhill. And the journey went on. And then, of course, you had your epiphany. And at about the same time, I think Jane Pike kind of galloped into my life, who's someone I know, you know, you work with and does all the mental side of the horsemanship. So then we started moving towards what I can only call the super woo.
Super woo.
So, you know, we can't fight the woo. And then I took all your principles and I took Jane's ideas, and I ended up thinking much more important than all the winning stuff and the, you know, the being number one and the silver cups and all the stuff I'd grown up with. Actually, what I wanted was to connect with my horse on a profound level. So we spent and do spend huge amounts of time just standing in our Scottish field, breathing and connecting and feeling each other on an atomic level. And I think of how I'm made of the ancient remnants of exploded stars, and so is she. And I sort of feel myself tiptoeing up to the very, very edge of the species barrier and just peering across. And she stands there doing all the things that ex-racehorses aren't supposed to do and all the things that red mares aren't supposed to do. And she's carved out of the Scottish air, you know, she's like a sort of extraordinary statue from ancient Greece. And I christened that the Place of Peace. So that was your idea essentially about connection and focus, and then with a little bit of Jane's idea of letting energy flow through one, which is an idea I really like. There's a paradox in this stillness, because we're so still when we do this. And bear in mind, this is an ex-racehorse in the middle of, I mean, she's got about 30 acres she can wander off into, and she doesn't have a halter on. So there we are, completely still, completely connected, but there's this incredible feeling of movement as you're in the stillness, because you've opened yourself up. Well, I have opened myself up to let the energy flow through. So it's a huge opening, and yet it's done in absolute immobility. And sounds quite good, actually, doesn't it, when I talk about it like that?
And she wasn't far wrong when she said it sounds good, like quite good when she talks about it like that. You know, I said before I played that there's some things that she said that have become part of our vernacular around here, and the super woo is one of them. You can't fight the woo is another one. But that part at the end where she talks about tiptoeing up to the edge of the species barrier and peering across, that just, yeah, I thought that was just poetry in motion. What did you think, hon?
Well, kind of like you said, I could listen to Tanya read anything or speak about anything. What I really find awesome about Tanya, I mean, I feel like we're like fast friends. We've known each other forever, but the reality isn't that. You heard in her, in what that little clip was, you know, she sought out Warwick, and she found Warwick before Warwick's had all this change. And so what I find really awesome is that what she did with how Warwick used to teach worked super well for her red mare. And then she took on board the super woo. Like, she went down the rabbit hole with us. And I just think that is amazing and a testament to her spirit. And maybe one of the reasons why I just love Tanya.
Yeah, she's a treasure, isn't she? You know, another treasure that popped up on the podcast was a fellow named Rupert Isaacson. So when I had Rupert on the podcast, I probably received as much positive feedback from Rupert's podcast than anybody else. But so Rupert is a filmmaker and an author and an activist. But he made a movie called The Horse Boy, where he took his autistic son Rowan to Mongolia to visit the horse shamans up there. He wrote a book about it called The Horse Boy. He wrote another book called The Long Journey Home, I think, and that has to do with three other subsequent healing journeys that he took Rowan on. And also he wrote a book called The Healing Land, which is about the Bushmen of the Kalahari. And as a kid, I was a huge fan of reading Wilbur Smith books, which are all about Africa. And I really got interested in all things Africa, but including the part of the shaman, the basically witch doctory side of the whole thing. And so I was interested in asking Rupert if he'd ever had any experience with that sort of stuff. But on the podcast, I was a bit concerned about doing it because Rupert and I actually recorded a podcast that went for about an hour long, and we were talking all things shaman. We got pretty deep into that and it was amazing. And then all of a sudden, all the machine, all the computer, you know, all the software, everything just quit while I was talking to Rupert. And, you know, it took me half an hour or so to get him back on the line. And I said, oh, sorry, Rupert, I don't know what happened. And he goes, oh, I do. He said, anytime we've been around shamans and you've got audio equipment or film or whatever, he said, if you ask the shamans if you can record things, they'll say yes, but most of the time they'll say, but it probably won't work. And there's something about that energy that interferes with technology. So when I talked to Rupert the second time, because the first recording disappeared off the face of the planet. So when I talked to Rupert the second time, I was trying to get the good stuff without getting too close to the good stuff. But I really wanted to hear about some of the amazing things that the Bushmen could do. And I told him a story about actually Jane Pike's husband. And Jane Pike's husband, Giles, he used to be a filmmaker for National Geographic. And he was in the jungle in the Congo. This is the story that Giles told me. And they were staying with a tribe there, and they'd go out into the jungle with the tribe filming every day, with the hunters filming every day, and they would be in the jungle for hours, and they'd come back from a different direction, but they'd always find their way back to the village. But there was, you know, the jungle's so thick, you can't tell what's what. You can go 10 feet from the village and don't know where the village is. And Giles asked the chief one day, you know, how do you find your way back to the village? And the guy says, oh, well, that's easy. We ask the animals. And Giles was like, I didn't see you talking to any animals. He goes, no, not, basically, this guy said, not vocally, but energetically and mentally. And Giles said, you guys can talk to the animals? And he's like, yeah, can't you? And Giles said, no. And the chief was kind of like, hey, kids, come over here. This guy can't talk to the animals. And so I think that's something that we're all born with the ability to do, and it gets drummed out of us. And later on, we'll talk about when we had Kerry Lake on the podcast, and she has never forgotten that. So I was really interested in asking Rupert about this. And so I asked him, I said, have you ever seen anything? I told him that story and asked him, have you ever seen anything like that? And this was his reply.
All the time.
Correct answer. Correct answer.
not just with the Bushmen, but in my daily life. But let's start with the Bushmen and others. All right, so I'll give you an example. I'm 27, I think, and I'm in Botswana. And this story is told, I think, in The Healing Land. I talked about it in The Long Ride Home too. And I'm with a group of Bushmen in this area that I've been displaced from. And they want to show me their old hunting techniques. And they say, look, Rupert, you know, we track like this. So it's not just about tracking. It's about communication with the animal. And we were tracking a chemsbok, which is a type of oryx with very long, straight horns, which is a notoriously dangerous animal to hunt because it will hunt you back when it knows that you're hunting it, and it will come for you. And, you know, it's coming for you with two swords. So I was scared because I knew this, that we were on the trail of this particular antelope. And but I also knew the antelope was a long way ahead. We saw him, we glimpsed him from time to time. And at a certain point, this guy Serra, who was the main hunter, said he looked down and there was a fresh dropping, animal dropping, from the chemsbok that he'd obviously done some minutes before where his tracks were. And he said, okay, he pointed to him, so he said, senior doctor, like this. He's smiling at me. He buries the poo in the back slot, the back track of the hind hoof print of the Hemsbok. And then he makes me and the other guys turn around and goes, okay, shut your eyes. And we have to stay there like this for about 10 breaths. And then he goes, okay, okay. And he turns me around. And there's the Hemsbok bull standing exactly a bow shot away, about 30 yards, presenting its shoulder for the arrow. These guys are no longer allowed to hunt because they've been displaced. They take these two imaginary arrows and they bows and they mime the shot. And in the time it takes for the imaginary arrow to reach the Hemsbok bull, it flinches and then it turns, it runs away. And he goes, ah, Ru. That was his name for Ru. This was our way. I don't know how many stories like that I have. I've seen leopards called out of the bush to the transfires during healing ceremonies. I've seen people say, I'm going to become leopard, and that happening, and then the person falls down and loses consciousness, and then you see a leopard get up and run away in the direction of the place where the person is that needs healing, and then the next morning that person, the swellings and the cancer seems to have gone. I mean, I don't know how many experiences I've had like that.
So I was fascinated with the hunting story that Rupert told, and then I was really fascinated by the shape-shifting story, you know, he alluded to at the end of that. But I thought, you know, this was at the end, almost at the end of a two-hour conversation, and I wanted to go there, but I didn't want to go there because if we start talking about that stuff and that shamanic energy messes with our computer, I'm going to lose 2 hours of conversation. And so I thought I'd probably never really have the chance to ask Rupert about that. And then a few months back now, Rupert came over. He lives in Germany. He came over to the west coast of the US, and his son Rowan came out from Austin, Texas, and they spent a week together at another podcast guest, Joelle Dunlap, at her place. And so they invited Robin and I up there for dinner. So this bit you're about to hear here is actually recorded in the kitchen while Rupert was cutting up a fish for dinner. So there is some kitchen noise in there, but we recorded this on our phone, so it doesn't sound very good, but you'll really get the gist of this. And luckily the phone worked, and hopefully this this recording works right here, and you get to hear the amazing stories that I heard.
Healing is just love. In fact, that's what all shamans, good shamans, say. But that with a certain training system, you can learn to direct it. By the same token, you could argue that empathy is shape-shifting, to put yourself in someone else's shoes. With a rigorous, several decades long training system, you could learn to be deliberate and directive about it. What that could mean is, I'll give you an example of something I've seen.
Let's just put these.
Here's an example. Besa, who was obviously my dude in the Kalahari, explained to me about why you might want to shapeshift in this way or that way. So he said, usually, if you're a bushman, you'll use a big cat. And you'll use lion if you want to do something heavy, not black magic, but something heavy. But if you want to do something quick, slight, even a little mischievous, you'll go leopard. And he talked to me about it, He said, what will happen is you'll dance until you fall down. And when you fall down, you enter leopard's body. Leopard will come, an actual physical one will come. You'll enter that leopard's body. Someone's got to stay with you in your body because you've left to make sure your body doesn't, no harm comes to it. And you go abroad as that animal and do whatever it is you need to do. Usually, it's always about healing. And then you
come back and you come back into your own body. And he said it to me, began to dance, fell down. His wife and family are there. A leopard comes close to the fire, and then you see the leopard go. But he's there. He's still unconscious there. And I've seen stuff like that 5, 6, 7 times. And that's an easy thing to say casually. What's more interesting is what they say when they come back and so forth. Or, for example, when we went up the mountain in Mongolia and our sound guy sees this white ibex. Well, A, ibexes are something you almost never see. B, to even know that you're seeing one, as opposed to a tar or some other type of mountain goat, and they have distinctive horns, but to see a white one, not going to see that. And our sound guy comes down, all freaked out, I just saw this, I was there. And the guides all go into this huddle immediately. And they're like, I don't know, should we go up there? And they've sort of come back and say, look, clearly the shaman has come down to have a look at us. But he's gone back up. We have no idea if it's welcoming or not, but he's come down as the white ibex to check us out. That's his way down the mountain. It's his quickest way down the mountain. So shape-shifted to the ibex. Go back up. And so we'll have to take the risk. And that night was a very funky night. My cameraman got afflicted by terrible giardia and just like vomited and shat all over. We didn't know if we'd have a camera to get up the mountain. To the point that Rowan said his first why question. He said, Michael, why are you spitting on it? And the was like off the cliffs of the mountain. And then wolves came that night and took down one of our horses. Or at least scared of. We never got that horse again. We never found that horse again. And we didn't know. One of the main things we could go on. And lots of mischief and got over. After we'd done the healing with Scub, I asked Ghost, who was the shaman, about that incident. And he had a little chuckle. And he just said, oh, anything can happen on that mountain. And I mean, I've just got loads of these. But the thing is, anyone who's worked in those contexts has a bunch of these stories. I'm not the only one. Where I'm lucky is that I have had it explained to me a few times. The process of it, and why you might do it, and why you might not do it. So, if you want to keep it clean, it's got to be for healing. If you make it unclean, then you can do it like the sort of Navajo skinwalker thing, where they go out to do each other harm. Mm-hmm. But that's black magic, and that will always kill you in the end. But yeah, there's a long conversation with this, but basically everybody does shapeshift. Often, actually. You project yourself into other people, other forms, other things. You just don't know you're doing it. But you can learn to become more conscious of it. That's what makes a good horse trainer. He projects himself into you, you project yourself into him. That's good anthropomorphism. Or from the horse's point of view, they can say that's good monkey training. But they're both doing it.
Yeah.
And you know when it's happening. You know as a horse trainer, you know what's happening. It's like that moment. And that moment is not when you exert your will on the horse. That moment is when it flows. And everyone understands everybody. And whatever the thing is that you're trying to achieve suddenly becomes easy. But there has to be a meeting. This happens within autism. You know, you're dealing with two completely different ways of looking at the world. If you can meet in the middle, I can become enough of you, you can become enough of me. But with this sort of thing, you can go trans-species and, yeah. I mean, anything can be explored to its apogee, I suppose. And that's, a large degree of what shapeshifting and shamanism is. Yeah.
Dang!
Let's eat.
You know, that whole amazing conversation started out with empathy is a form of shapeshifting. And later on, Rupert we got talking about horse training, and he said, you know, that, you know, when you are an empathetic horse trainer, you're a shapeshifter because you're putting yourself into the horse's shoes. But the bit about the leopard by the fire and blah, 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 and the next day the person with the cancer is cured or whatever, but then what the shaman tells you, you know, what was that line he said? He said, that's not the most amazing part, that the fact it happened, but it's what they tell you when they come back about what happened. That's, that's the mind-boggling stuff. But, I'm so glad I got to question Rupert about that in the kitchen while he was cutting up a fish.
Yeah, that whole night, I mean, the podcast was great, but the whole night that we spent with Rupert and Rowan and Joelle and her husband, that was just unreal. And, you know, Rupert is such a great father, and seeing them interact was really something special. I'm really humbled and honored that we got to spend those hours with them. And so I hope you will go back and listen to that whole podcast.
Yeah, that whole podcast with Rupert was one of those before and after moments. Like, there's life before listening to that podcast with Rupert, and there's life after, at least for me that was the case. But I've had so many people contact me about that podcast with Rupert and just say, that guy is something else. And yeah, it was pretty amazing. Another amazing guest and storyteller was my friend Kelly Wilson from New Zealand, and she's traveled all over the world photographing wild horses, and some of her observations about wild horses just absolutely blew me away. You know, we're in the horse world, we're kind of taught to not anthropomorphize, and anthropomorphizing is giving, projecting onto animals, you know, human emotions or human qualities, things like that. But I think sometimes in the doing of that, we get a bit too far away, because we have to remember they're mammals. And so, you know, you got to kind of determine, are you anthropomorphizing or are you mammalizing? If you're mammalizing, you are not saying they have human qualities. You're giving them the qualities of mammals. And Kelly told me three different stories about wild horses that the stories are definitely mammalizing, and it's almost, you would think it would be almost bordering on anthropomorphizing, because these are, I don't know, way more human traits than we ever gave horses credit for. It's almost a bit like when I watched the movie My Octopus Teacher, and you kind of get that feeling from that. But have a listen to these stories Kelly told me, and I mean, they just blew me away, and I'm pretty sure they'll blow you away too.
So he was a phenomenal resource, Wayne McCrory, and we went in and stayed with the First Nations, the Honey Tribe. And it was just an incredible experience. So same thing, we were tracking horses. And it was the first country that I'd been in that was controlled solely by predators. So it was kind of like the Lion King, the full circle of life. And unlike other countries, they're not having to be managed by humans, because the balance and the ecosystem is working in their favor. And so some of the observations we made, I was starting to see a baseline, a universal baseline for how wild horses behave and how horses in general can behave, and then also starting to see dissimilarities. So in Canada at one point, we came across a bachelor band, and again, these were really wild horses. So in the burnt forest, which had burnt in 2017, we were lucky to get within a kilometre of these bands, because they were just so flighty. And if it was just me on foot tracking them alone with a lot of patience and really reading their body language, I could probably get within 500 metres of some of these bands, but often a lot of our observations were made at a greater distance. And so we came across these three bachelors that were at a waterhole, and I remember we stopped the four-wheel drive, hopped out, and the horses bolted. And these were quite flighty, so I would have expected over in Australia they would have like bolted and just disappeared from sight. But these ones only galloped for about maybe 200 meters, and then they turned around and faced us. And they were snorting, and everything about their body language showed extreme tension. And I couldn't understand why they were holding their ground, because from what I was observing, they shouldn't have felt comfortable. They should have kept that flight response. And they were sounding an alarm. And within the next 3 minutes, as we observed, 43 other horses galloped into the clearing and surrounded them. And it was just mind-blowing that it was actually 8 individual bands, which we worked out, from tracking them for 2 days. But they'd come together in time of emergency to work as a unit to protect each other. And they actually remained as one unit for the entire time that we were with them. And there was two stallions that really made an impact on me. And it was one that had a broken hind leg, which, was obviously pretty difficult to see, and he couldn't keep up and he was dragging in his leg. And he had a bachelor buddy that was obviously, he'd paired up with. And you could see the absolute distress with the sound bachelor, because he felt safer being with the 47, but was constantly coming back to check his broken-legged friend. So he would prance beside the injured stallion for maybe 5-10 minutes, and then he'd gallop ahead, spend some time in the mob, then he'd gallop back, hang out with the injured one, because this horse obviously couldn't keep up. And on one of these times that he galloped ahead, another stallion came out of the trees and started fighting with the injured stallion. And the healthy stallion heard the sounds of distress from this injured one, and he actually galloped back and fought on his friend's behalf and drove off the other stallion, and then remained with him after that. So it was pretty incredible. Obviously, you read books about stallions that will fight to the death to protect their family, but to see two bachelors, doing it from a friend kind of perspective was, one of probably the most profound moments that I witnessed around the world with the wild horses.
I'm having a bit of a moment here hearing that story.
Yeah, it was pretty tough to witness. And I mean, I guess one of the things that I really came to understand is that nature really is, it is tough. And, for these wild horses to survive, they really often have to go through quite a lot.
That's me heavy breathing. Well, I was just picturing that whole thing, and that must have been such an amazing experience to see all of that stuff. Because a lot of the let's call it dogma that we get taught about horses is based on interactions between domesticated horses in small areas with limited resources. Piles of hay, one waterer, stuff like that. And then we get told, this happens this way and this happens this way. But to be actually see that. Better observe that behavior in the wild, especially with horses that sound like they're completely wild, must have been amazing.
Yeah, so another moment that really stood out, and it actually was evident in every country. In New Zealand, there was a band of, I think, about 10 horses, and quite often there's 2 or 3 stallions in each band. And I'd seen it, in Australia, and it was just, I hadn't really thought beyond it. And then in the Australian desert, I saw it again, and it was a stallion that was skinny, stressed, absolutely wasn't tolerated by the stallion he was shadowing, and he was really beaten up. So I couldn't understand why the stallion was showing loyalty to another stallion that obviously didn't want him around. And, there was obviously a lot of anxiety in this horse. He was covered in bite marks, and the other stallion really wasn't fond of him. And we kind of made a few assumptions with the professor, and it wasn't until I'd witnessed the same thing in America and then New Zealand, and had photographs of these horses that go back several years that I was able to piece it together. So quite often multiple stallions in a band come from horses that were bachelor buddies. And, you know, they grew up as mates, and then one of them got the strength to win a mare of his own. And, you know, these stallions just remained together with one of them keeping the mares. And then I pieced together another reason why stallions have multiple in a band. And I was able to track back that the same sort of situation had happened in New Zealand. There was a really healthy stallion with all these mares and foals. And then there was this really beaten up, battle scarred, injured stallion that tracked them. And he was never allowed any of the mares. He wasn't tolerated. He was skinny. He was often anxious. And 3 years earlier, the healthy stallion had won this older stallion's mare. And so this injured stallion, his loyalty wasn't to the other stallion. His loyalty was to one of the stallion's mares who used to be his mare. And so for 3 years, he'd been tracking this band from a distance because he didn't want to let his mare out of sight. And I'd seen the same thing happen in America with Cloud in the Prior Mountains, and then another stallion called White Spirit, where these stallions don't have the strength or the soundness to maintain their own bands, but they just shadow the last mares that they had.
Wow, it's almost like mating for life sort of thing.
Yeah, in some of these instances it is. So I've got, you know, one stallion in New Zealand who we've documented for, you know, over a decade, and he still has his original mare. So as a young bachelor stallion, he won his first mare. She's still his lead mare today.
You know, I'm so grateful to Kelly for sharing those stories because, you know, those things are not things I've ever read anywhere or heard about, but having her relay those stories just really got me to, you know, it's part of that whole thing that helps you start to view the world a bit of a different way. And yeah, I love chatting with Kelly about that stuff. So anyway, I have talked about some of my favorite moments, and I've got more to come, but I better let Robin have a bit of a share of this thing and share some of her favorite moments from the podcast.
Thanks, babe. All right. Well, I chose Mustang Maddie, and we were fortunate enough to meet Maddie in Arizona, and she's just wise beyond her years. And the part that I picked the context is they're talking about the different types of reinforcement you can use, positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. And, you know, I guess once I learned about these different ways of, you know, approaching your horse, and I guess there was a little bit of shame in that, you know, you use the negative reinforcement and maybe that there's a better way. And so, you know, you kind of try the other side. And I just thought that Maddie gave a great example of how either way can work well, and that it all comes down to listening to the horse. And I just thought that she did a really good job of explaining this. So here is what I picked for one of my aha moments.
It's the it depends. And I do think both, you know, both sides of the coin, both, you mentioned attunement a minute ago, both of them, the more attuned you can be, the better it works. I mean, it doesn't matter which one you're using, if you're using positive or negative reinforcement.
You know, and that's the whole thing with like force-free training or, you know, things like that. It's like you can use food in a way that is very forceful and very coercive and very, you have to do this or else, just like the same can be said for pressure. And, you know, Warwick, for me, again, I could go just totally all into this, but one really big takeaway for me too, as far as seeing, you know, ethics and training beyond this method or that method, is control, the amount of control that the animal has. So if you're using pressure, does the animal have control to avoid the pressure to begin with? That's where we get all of our lightness, right? And all the ways, you know, natural horsemanship or whatever you want to call it has served us. And also, are you diagnosing why the horse isn't doing what they're doing. Like, what's your diagnosis? And is your prognosis just to add more pressure and keep escalating? Well, if that's the case, yes, you're using pressure in a way where the animal has very little control. And it's been shown that stressors aren't necessarily damaging to an animal. It's whether the animal has control over that stressor or not. And that's when they don't have control. That's when they, you know, their immune system is affected. They can go into shutdown and all of these other potential health challenges come up. But if you're using food in a way where the animal doesn't have control over that reinforcer and you're using poor shaping and you're not listening to those natural signs of the horse being at threshold, you know, then again, you're just going into a different training method with the same, like the same controlling kind of mindset and coercion, where you're just not listening to the horse. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, right? Is listening to the horse.
Yep. And being able to read the signs and, yeah, see the signs, read the signs, interpret the signs.
So that was my aha moment with Maddie. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, learning about the new ways that you can approach horses, I felt a little shame. But, you know, when it gets down to it, like Maddie said, it's about listening to the horse. And now we have so many more tools in our toolbox to do that. And so I feel really good about that. But I just thought that was a great little snippet from her podcast. The whole thing is incredible. I can actually remember, I don't know if you guys do this, but when I'm listening to the podcast, I can actually remember where I was when I was listening to them. And when I listened to Maddie's, we were driving to a horse show and we were actually, we had just pulled off of Highway 5. We were at the top of the Grapevine and we were going to cut through, Lancaster. So we were driving around this lake and I can remember exactly where we were when we listened to the podcast, to this podcast particularly. So just, I don't know if that's just the way my mind works, but I do that with all of them. I can kind of remember where I was and what I was doing when I was listening to them. Kind of cool.
Yeah, Maddie is pretty cool. And it was an interesting conversation about sometimes that positive reinforcement can cause more stress than negative reinforcement. And I'm on a Facebook group right now that's called Cherry on Top Trainers. And it's basically people who use the positive reinforcement is a cherry on top of everything else. And it's been interesting listening to that because they really have got, they really have got into the science of, you know, when the dopamine is released and with all the different quadrants and things like that. And it's fascinating. That's another whole rabbit hole you can go down. If you want to go down the human rabbit hole of that, like the science behind why a person might choose to do one particular quadrant of the training, you know, over another one, the podcast I did with Sarah Schlotte, who's a trauma therapist from Canada, it was amazing. I'd love to include parts of that here, but there was just so much to it. It would be hard to cut out the one bit that would make the big difference. But if you're interested in why some people are quite polarized about using positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement, go and have a listen to that one with Sarah because, she covered a lot of ground as to why a person might choose one over the other.
My second choice was Carrie Lake. And Carrie, I mean, the whole podcast is awesome. Anything Carrie says is awesome. Her books are great. It was actually her book, Listening Like a Horse, that got me really thinking about why I was competing. I'll read a little bit about what that excerpt in the book was. She said, it can be valuable to explore whether we are wanting to be with the horses because we are in love with horses, or if we are using horses to carry us to a place where we approve of ourselves. Boom. Neither is the right or wrong way to be, but when we have clarity in the answer to that question, the horses are able to give us so much more. We are open to receive their efforts without resistance. So, you know, that really hit me and got me thinking about got me questioning, got me curious. So the whole book is dog-eared and there are post-it notes all over it, but that's what really got me thinking. And, you know, we were lucky enough to have Carrie here in June of 2021 for 4 days with a handful of other people for a clinic. And then Warwick and I kept her here for 2 days of one-on-ones. And I've worked with her since, you know, just on Zoom, and she's just helped me in ways that I just can't describe and probably don't even know yet how it's unraveling. But one of the things that stuck with me of all the things she said kind of correlates to the piece in her podcast that I want others to take away. And I'll play that in a second, but we were discussing, you know, finding my purpose. And she said, and I'm paraphrasing now, but she said, what if your purpose is simply that you are here, that your presence is enough of a purpose? And of course, I'm like, no, what's the thing, Carrie? What's the thing that I'm supposed to be doing? What's my purpose? You know, I still struggle with that. I thought it was awesome, and it's given me a lot to think about, that maybe she's right. And maybe, you know, what I'm doing is already enough. But anyway, so it kind of correlates to what she said about the greatest thing that she learned from spending 18 months with Penelope Smith, the grandmother of animal communication. And I'll play that now.
No matter how much structure I can get from somebody's system or modality, or how much there is to learn from that, the real gold and the real value is in trusting myself, trusting my own senses, trusting what feels true to me, even if it doesn't sound the same as other people.
So instead of looking for the thing that I can define as my purpose, I'm learning to trust myself and what feels true to me, thanks to Carrie. The other thing that Carrie talks about a lot, and I think is just the answer to everything after I've worked with her, is, you know, feeling with your heart, opening your heart, and listening to what it says. And that has been probably my biggest lesson from Carrie. And she calls it Heart Center Open. And I find myself using that tool so much in everyday life. So yeah, I just highly recommend listening to Carrie's story. And she's an amazing, amazing person.
Yeah, I love chatting with Carrie on the podcast. And it was great having her here. She's just one of those people that you just feel better about being in her presence, whether it's in real life or whether you're just having a conversation on a podcast. But yeah, she's a pretty special human being, that one. The next amazing guest I want to talk about is a lady named Terry Kubler. And Terry came to that thing that Kerry Lake did at our house. But I had met Terry a week before at a horse expo, and Terry trained animals for movies. You know, she trained an owl for Harry Potter, and I think she trained one of the Mr. Bigglesworths for the Austin Powers movies. And Terry has an amazing connection with animals. And one of the amazing stories she was telling me, she had had a near-death experience, and I'd overheard her talking about it when she was here for the Kerry Lake clinic, and I didn't quite get the whole story of it, so I wanted to repeat it on the podcast. And what came out of her mouth, this story, this is one of my favorite stories I've ever heard a human being tell.
Well, you're talking about the near-death experience, and you know how, so that, you know, you said it was life-changing, so that was kind of your introduction to, yes, I do have spirit guides, I have angels, I, you know, there's a bit more to this.
I have intuition that is right, that I can listen to. Yeah. So coming back, it was then I turned into, I guess, what you'd call a seeker. Like, now I got to know. Now I got to learn more about this. How do I develop my intuition? What am I supposed to do with it? I was just filled with all these questions of what's my purpose? Where's my teachers? What, you know, how do I learn this? How do I become better at this? Yeah, it was, so I, you know, I went to every horse clinic I could go to. I went to every spiritual teacher I could, you know, follow around. And I just was filled with questions. So one day I'm walking the chatter in my head was just, you know, where's my teacher? How am I going to learn this? What am I supposed to do? And on and on and on. And finally, I just heard this voice that said, shh. And I went, what? And the chatter went right back, like, what was that? What's that supposed to mean? And it very, be quiet. And so I got quiet and my brain kicked back in. Yeah, but I need a teacher. And the voice came back and said, I'm sending you the best on the planet. I went crazy in my head of, oh, but I missed them. I don't know how to find them. Where do you know, how will I know them when I meet them? Blah, blah, blah. And in that second, I look down and I'm walking with a 500-pound male African lion strolling along by my side. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm so slow. And so from that point on, it's like, ah, the animals, of course, they've always been my teachers. They'll all, you know, and that's where my training shifted, of me becoming the student of the animals rather than their trainer, teacher, whatever. They had a lot more answers than I did. So
you told me a bit of a, not a crazy story, crazy good story about, was it an eagle?
Ah, yeah. Yes. I worked a lot with an eagle. He's actually ended up being in shamanism, my spirit guide, my power animal was the eagle. And that was so appropriate because this eagle that I worked with a lot, I don't remember the story that I told you, but
something about looking at him and him looking at you.
Oh, that's right. I was training him. I was training the eagle to fly. Which sounds so stupid, but that was the trainer mentality of, oh, I'm going to take you out and teach you how to fly. And what I meant was fly on cue. But so we were flying this eagle across a field and feeding. He would get the reward of a small chicken heart when he flew to your arm. And at one point, he flew across the field and he veered way off to the left. And it was a field that was knee deep in high grass. And he veered off, found a chicken heart that we must have dropped walking across the field, and then flew back and sat on my arm. And the look that he cocked his head and looked me right in the eye. And I just got the message, I need you like a hole in the head. You're not teaching me anything. And that was a moment of aha. I just, that moment broke me into tears, that I had that egotistical mentality of being higher on the hierarchy than this magnificent bird, you know. And at that moment, I changed to, I am so grateful to be in your presence. And, you know, what a gift this is that you are willing to even be around me. So I started spending much more just time being quiet and sitting with him and trying to view the world through an eagle's eyes. And, you know, it was an amazing shift for me. And it changed our whole relationship, in that then came the trust, because then I would take him on set that would be very chaotic and loud. And instead of normally before he would have tried to fly off and take care of himself, he would just snuggle up to me like, I know you got my back, you know, that kind of. So we developed that kind of a relationship. But it was because of the shift in my mentality of respecting who he was as a sentient being.
What a great line that was. Respecting who he was as a sentient being. And Terry's story about the lion, that just blew me away. And speaking of cats, when I met her at the horse expo,
we had a little something go on, and that was another part of her podcast that I thought was just a highlight for me. So have a listen to this and see what you think.
Yeah, well, you actually recently, when we met at the Horse Expo, I had, so last week on the podcast when I talked to Jessica Whiteplume, I mentioned about different psychedelics I'd tried in healing situations, and I had said that I had microdosed mushrooms early last year for about 10 days, and that during that 10 days my cat would sit in my lap every night and not want to get up. And I have mentioned it in earlier episodes of the podcast too. So I was telling Terry about this at the Horse Expo, and when we were packing up to leave the Horse Expo, Kendall, that works for me, she said, "Oh, there's a note here from Terry." And I look at this note, and it's an explanation of why the cat sat in my lap. And so I'm like, okay, well, that's okay, good to know. But talking to Terry a couple of weeks later, I found out that she actually went on a shamanic journey to get that information.
Yeah, it didn't come from me because it was news to me. That's why I did the journey, because it intrigued me. And I thought, now I have to know. I have to know why that cat was so attracted to that energy or what that was about. So I don't have the answer. I didn't have a clue of what was going on. So I asked the question, and I think I wrote the question at the top of the answer that I gave you. I asked the question, went on a journey, and then I journaled what I got. And it was very interesting. I don't even remember all of what was in there, but it was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. Oh, that, I won't look at cats the same anymore.
Can I grab that and read it?
Oh, sure, sure. It wasn't from me.
Okay.
So I'm thinking the question is probably written across the top. Is that right?
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. That was part of the learning, was how to craft a question, because spirit will answer you back exactly according to what you asked, and only that. So you don't want to ask yes or no questions, because you'll get a yes or no.
This sheet of paper I've got here in Terry's very nice handwriting says, "Why would a cat be attracted to a person microdosing in mushrooms?" And then I guess this is some sort of a download you got from your spirit guide. It says, "It's a frequency exchange. Cats normally are aware of a different plane of existence than humans are. They walk in two planes at once. They're extremely aware of higher frequencies, changes in atmospheric pressures, and changes in fields of energy. In many cultures who seek spiritual awareness, the cat is revered as a conduit to the spiritual realms. The Egyptians used cats in their temples because the cat's ability to resonate and recognize spiritual energies, both bad and good. The cat was both a guardian and a portal. The mushroom raised Warwick's frequency, and the cat was acknowledging the shift. He was gratified that Warwick was becoming more cat-like while assisting in balancing the new energies through blocked chakras so Warwick could maintain the higher frequencies." There you have it. And so none of that's you?
No. No, because it was all news to me. It's like, oh, how interesting. That's fantastic. And that's what happens to me when I channel right. I'll get answers that I know are not coming from me because I don't know. I'll have the reaction of, oh, that's cool. Or I have to do more research on that, you know, because that's really interesting.
So I think that's the super woo that Tanya Kindersley was talking about. What do you think, babe?
For sure. You know, I made Tanya a sweatshirt that said super woo on it. I hope she wears it in Scotland when it's cold outside as one of her layers. Anyway, that is a good segue. I think all of those from Terry are a good segue into a clip that I listened to and picked out. That was from your podcast with Sarah Schlatte. And it's you speaking, but I just felt like this excerpt was so important for everybody to understand. And then after we listen to that, we're going to go into some more with Josh Nickel, and we'll see how that all it just all builds on each other.
I had posted a YouTube video about energy and intention with horses, and a girl replied and said, yeah, I was at a horsemanship clinic a few years ago, and we're in the arena, and there some horses outside the arena were getting trotted down a hill that was a pavement or something or other, and it was making a lot of noise, and my horse reared up. Mm-hmm. And the clinician yelled at me, stop pulling on him. And she said, I yelled back, I'm not, the lead rope's completely loose. And he said something to her like, no, internally, not externally. And he was standing there on his hind feet rearing up, and she may as well have been pulling on the lead rope, because all her internal energy was saying, don't do that, stop, instead of, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, look at you standing on your hind legs. But her whole internal being was screaming, don't, and she said, and as soon as he said that, I kind of softened and gave away the judgment of what was happening, and a horse just came back down and just stood there. But the whole time that she was rejecting that and having a visceral reaction to it, her horse was tense. And that's the hard thing about this stuff, and that's why I want to talk to you, because I want really want people to understand that I think everybody has trauma. Everybody. And if you're around your horse and you haven't started to work on that stuff, there's going to be quite an element of that. And it supersedes or it overrides any physical thing you may do with your body, you know, like any aids or cues or whatever you might give. Mm-hmm. That stuff inside of you has those horses read that way more than the left leg, right leg, left hand, right hand, whatever it is you're doing. And it's a deep subject, and I don't mean deep as in profound, it is that too, but there's a lot to it. But it's such a huge part of getting along with not just horses, with any other sentient being as well, but especially trying to get along with your horse, you know.
You know, that little clip there was from me, not from Sarah. I think Sarah's podcast is really worth a listen, re-listen to, because she comes at everything from a trauma therapist perspective. And when you really start to understand where your training style comes from and why and how, you know, the reasons why you choose to interact with your horse in different ways. It's a bit of a life change, but it's all, you know, that there was a bit about your energy. And someone who was really on about energy and said things in such a great way was when I chatted with Josh Nicol. Josh is another one of those podcasts, because, in doing this episode of the podcast, we've been re-listening to podcasts and finding snippets and stuff in there. And Josh's podcast, when I re-listened to it, I was like, I could just replay the whole thing, because he was just so cool about stuff. But anyway, this bit here is one of my favorite clips from the podcast with Josh.
What I feel like I 100% agree that the horses they have feelings and they have emotions and they have interactions and they desire that interaction. I think what happened is, one of the things that I often talk about to talk about the difference is I look at the difference between what I call relational horsemanship and maybe more of a reactive emotional horsemanship. And emotional horsemanship says when the horse does something, it's a demonstration of respect or disrespect. And that then justifies emotional pressure. So if the horse disrespects you, you can't let that happen. So then you feel justified to apply an emotional pressure. And that's an interpretation in your mind. So that really sets a tone of a very non-relational type of presentation. And you could take that to all of life. You know, if you were to do that, you know, with a person and you interpret what they're saying as disrespectful, feel pretty justified to defend yourself. And then relational horsemanship being when a horse is struggling with something, which they will, and they will express that in many ways. And it's important that we listen to those ways, because that gives us a bit of insight about how they're feeling and where they're at. It's a demonstration of met or unmet needs. And when we can start seeing the conversation of what our horses are speaking to us, and in relationship, it's important that there's two very valid opinions, that the horse speaks and has their opinion. then it's now our job to step in and try to meet their needs. And, you know, we might chat a little bit more about some of this specifically, but that changes your intention and your energy now. The frequency of feeling disrespected and kind of personally attacked and then justifying emotional pressure and the difference between seeing that there's an unmet need and it's my job to meet it changes absolutely the frequency you give off. So now you stand there before the horse in calmness and more of an empathetic perspective versus upset, frustrated, you know, and now that just puts you into a position. If you're going to get the horse to do something and you're charged by those energies and emotions, it's going to turn into more of a dominant focus because the horse is not going to want to have anything to do with you. So I find that when we talk about, you know, you're saying there that, you know, the feelings they have are important. Well, the first thing I think is important is people start understanding that. And I think that was, you know, starting to happen a little bit more in years previous was your horse is not trying to disrespect you. But in the beginning, we said, yes, they are. They're disrespecting you and you can't let that happen. And then people say, no, don't emotionalize that. You know, it's not, they're not doing that to strike out at you. But that doesn't mean they don't have emotions. It just means that those emotions might not be your judgment of what you think they're doing it for. And I feel like that's where it frees us, right? Because now we can say, yeah, I want to hear from you. I know when you're speaking to me, it's a demonstration of met or unmet needs. And I need to hear that because that gives me some insight about what I'm presenting to you. And those, your voice is really important. And for me, once you do that, man, the voice of the horse starts showing up and they start feeling confident instead of feeling desensitized and dulled out that their voice is not allowed to be heard. They feel free to start communicating. And to me, that's when the horse enters more of the universal language. So now they're speaking with you and you're able to communicate with them on a much deeper level. And that honestly, that's where the good stuff starts is when the horses feel like they're allowed to communicate. And obviously we want to all be safe and we want to, you know, take care of certain elements, but man, to me, it just starts getting good when the horse feels free enough to be in that interaction and they're not, feeling like they're going to get in trouble or going to get chased or, you know, any of those, you know, maybe the more dominant type presentations.
You know, the passion that Josh has for that way of thinking, it really comes out. You can really hear it and feel it in the energy of his voice right there. But yeah, I used to be of the opinion of, you know, a horse is disrespecting you. And I, you know, I've completely changed that. And it's funny, when you change that, it changes the way you go about everything. And then you see changes in the horse and then you realize, oh, back when I thought that was right, it was so wrong, it wasn't funny. But, you know, everybody's at the place they're at. And I think at least at some point in time, we all go through that point. But once you get through that point, I think it really changes who you are and how you interact with everybody, you know, not just your horses. And that's something I said that to Josh. And then his reply to that, I thought was worth playing here on this episode.
Oh, I just agree 100%. I feel like there's all of these ways. I think that it's, I like to look at it more like an enlightened philosophy. And that way of existing on the world, for every person, it's somehow written in their DNA that they're drawn to a certain art, to that kind of draws them to it. And for us, you're right, it's horses. You know, a lot of people look for spirituality or religion, or they look for things to connect. But for us, I feel like our enlightenment is drawn out by horses. And for some, maybe it's martial arts, and for others, something else. But I feel like when you feel and see the way, you know you've been touched by it when you see how cross borders it becomes. Because now it changes. You can't look at your wife the same. You can't look at the students the same. There's a depth of love and empathy and kindness that starts to come out of your bones because it's changed you. And that's why I feel like it's a way. It either, when you really see it, you become different. And I feel like, you know, there was we had, you know, chatted a little bit or sent me there the ideas of some questions and some things to talk about. And man, boy, that's the deal right there. When people, there's no bigger gift that we can give people than to help them see and understand a way of existing on this earth that brings depth of joy and connection and relationship. And pretty soon it doesn't matter what you touch. And I feel like every creature on the planet desires that depth and relationship. And when we let it out of us, when we touch it a bit, it draws people in. It draws horses in. It makes people feel comfortable and safe and calm. And honestly, that's the beauty of it. So I feel like that's kind of a telltale for people, is when you see that this style starts to shift and change your entire life philosophy, you know you're starting to see things in more of a philosophical, universal spectrum. And now you're touching stuff that just it changes you. You cannot be the same person once it starts to sink into your being. And I think that whole relational perspective versus a more emotional or dominant perspective, you know, when we're in a self-preserving, more dominant perspective, we push everything away just trying to keep what we have. It's more of a scarcity-based perspective. And when we really touch this more relational way of being, there is such abundance in the energy. And, you know, it's almost like, I feel like people often ask me that, why I'm not so tired by the amount of work that goes into the things that we do. And there was a time I was exhausted. I was way more tired. But the more I start to tap into this deeper scope, I feel like I'm supercharged all the time, because it's like I'm touching something different. I'm into something else. And that's, anyways, I think we're kind of saying the same thing in two different ways, it's true. And that's the best way I can tell people, is if you feel like it's starting to change the way you speak to your wife or your husband, and it's different in how you start processing the judgments you make or the perspectives you have, you know you're starting to touch a more universal concept of relationship. And I think that's, when I say relational horsemanship, you know, I really try to focus on the relational part, and then horsemanship kind of fades off. It's like, yeah, it's to do with horses. But the only way you're going to really get this is if you're thinking about it, not just when you're with your horse.
You know, I think that last thing of Josh's right there just really sums up what we're on about here on this podcast. And yeah, like I said, I think everything that Josh said in the whole podcast was amazing. It's worth another listen to. But there was something he said in the podcast which was a one-liner, and probably there were two one-liners out of the whole 60-something episodes that I thought were just hit it spot on. And here, this is what Josh's one-liner was.
Don't take from me what is for me to give you.
Don't take from me what is for me to give you. How about that? Just sit there and marinate on that one a few times. I'll tell you what, another one-liner that was a highlight of the whole 63 episodes was the episode when I talked to Leslie Desmond. And the one-liner that she said in there was, yes has no value if no is not an option. And that's one of the ones you got to sit there and think about it for a while, and then think, you know, and it all comes back to, you know, giving the horses a voice and allowing them to say no. And, you know, because think about that. Yes has no value if no is not an option. Just something to really sit and stare at the wall about. But I kind of expected something like that out of Leslie. But probably the biggest surprise guest I had on the podcast was when I had Karen Rolfe on the podcast. So Karen has a business called Dressage Naturally, and I didn't know anything about her, but I had a lot of people suggest I have her on there. So she was on the podcast. We'd been talking for about an hour, and she hadn't ventured off into the woo-woo at all. So I thought, that's fine. We don't need to go to the woo. She's not woo. And then I was talking about my experiences with dialectical behavior therapy and talking about counting judgmental thoughts. And I spoke about the value of that. And she said, yeah, well, that's part of the Toltec philosophy. That's the four agreements. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And so she talked a little bit about a book called The Four Agreements. And so when it came time to ask her the podcast guest questions, the first question I asked her was, what book do you recommend? And I said, is that the book you're referring to before? And what came out of her mouth right after that just completely blew me away.
And the first one that you chose was, what book do you recommend? So is this the same book, or is there a different book that is?
Yeah, no, it was The Four Agreements. This book, you can read it in a day. And it's like this nice light reading until you try to actually live by it. But I read this book, and then at the end, the back cover, it was like, you know, contact this website to do power journeys with Miguel, the author. And I went, okay. So like a month later, I found myself, you know, in Teotihuacan, Mexico, on top of the Pyramid of the Sun with a Toltec shaman, like experiencing some pretty crazy stuff. And then worked with one of his apprentices. And it's, I just really loved the philosophy and the agreements. And it's all about knowing yourself and your book of rules, and then deciding who made that rule and do you choose it? So, which is, again, is simple, but not so easy.
The podcast just took a turn. Because you don't know that, like, Karen Rolfe knows nothing about me, but podcast listeners would know that I'm extremely into anything shaman-wise. I read books on shamanism. I had no idea that Karen Rolfe was into anything like that. But thinking about, you know, where she's at in life, of course she is. I mean, you don't get there without that. Tell me, I'm a shaman groupie, so.
Miguel Ruiz is just, I've gotten to spend a bit of time, not a lot, but a bit of time with him. And he's just the real deal. I mean, you're with him and you can walk in a room and you sit in there and all of a sudden everybody's giggling. Okay. He's just sitting in the front of the room being. Another time you walk in the room and it's like, whoa. And it's more power than you've ever felt in a room. And he just bees. He just is. And he does a lot of teachings. You can find him on Facebook. You can Google him. You can, you know, he has some beautiful, beautiful books. The Four Agreements and the Mastery of Love are my favorites. And it's so simple. It's so sweet.
What
and
was
it's
the second
so
one?
Hard. The Mastery of Love.
The Mastery of Love. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, it's crazy stuff. Like, we were on top of the Pyramid of the Sun, this whole big group, and we're meditating. And then I see him, like, I'm like peeking, right? Because I want to know what's going on. And I see him on the other side of the Pyramid of the Sun, and he's like looking over, and he just like would look at someone, and then he'd like, and then I'd look over across, and like the person would just like, whoop, lay down, and their eyes were closed. He was like putting people in trances. Anyway, there was that. And then there was another meditation we were doing, and it was an open eye meditation. And we're in this space, and he wouldn't tell us any of the mythology or history of the spaces we were in, because he didn't want us thinking. So we're just staring at the space, and then it was a really tight space. And then he came along and sat in front of me, and just, you know, we like locked eyes and did that for a little while, and then I had this visualization. It was really cool. And then he left, and later we're talking with the group, and I told the story, and I said, yeah, and then Miguel came and sat in front of me, and everybody around me, I mean, we're smushed in. They were like, Miguel wasn't here. I was, yes, he was. He sat right in front of me. He stepped over your legs. He had his hand on my heart, you know, for about 5 minutes. And they're like, he wasn't there. And so I looked at our group leader, and I said, Miguel was here, right? And she said, yeah, he was there. And then I said, why didn't anybody else see him? And she said, because he didn't want them to. I was like, wow, that's mastery of your intention.
That's, oh, thank you, yeah. Karen. You've made my day, because you have now, you are now a true Journey on podcast guest, because that's the sort of story I want out of everybody. So if you've got any more, spit them out. So we went from talking about dressage and stuff like that to being at the Temple of the Sun with a shaman who could make himself disappear with some people. So that was quite a surprise. Now, what was not a surprise is when I had Tristan Tucker on the podcast, my son Tyler and I had spent a little bit of time with Tristan in Holland, probably a year before we had him on the podcast. And we spent 3.5 hours at Tristan's place, and when we got in the car, and we looked at each other, Tyler and I looked at each other, and we're like, that's the most interesting human being I've ever met in my entire life. So I knew some of the stuff he was going to talk about in the podcast was going to be pretty out there or pretty interesting, and it definitely was. And he's one of those podcasts I could just play the whole thing for you. But probably the clip I want to play from him was
when I asked him once again, it's about books, what book do you recommend the most? And his answer was, you know, I thought it was going to be some philosophical book or, you know, some sort of a personal growth book. And it was neither of those. And his book recommendation was one of the most interesting ones out of any other podcast.
Actually, in most recent times, I'm heavily influenced or feed off my father-in-law, who's a visual optometrist. And the correlation between the work he's doing with humans and what I'm trying to understand about horses is getting more and more on one line. He gave me a book called Psychobehavioral Visual Enhancement by an Albert Shankman.
And so the name of the book is what?
Psychobehavioral Visual Enhancement.
Why does that not surprise me that you've just recommended a book called Psychobehavioral Visual Enhancement? So your father-in-law is a visual optometrist.
Yeah.
What does a visual optometrist do?
For instance, you have, he's the opposite of an eye surgeon. He is very much connected with your visual system being the system where you absorb the most information and it affects you mentally, emotionally, physically. It's whether you're in balance or not. If you have a visual problem, it's a brain problem, not an eye problem. The coordination between your eyes. He's helping a lot of children with diagnosed with autism, ADHD, children that need to have a pill to go to school, people with migraines, people with dizziness, people that can't sleep. He deals with high-performance athletes, tennis players. They all can serve at 100 and whatever kilometers an hour. The ones that have a fast visual system that are trained to be able to dictate where the ball is going to be within the space, depending on the other player's body language and trajectory of the ball. All those measurements can be made through your visual system. So he's giving athletes this ability to have amazing speed through their visual system.
So I told you he's the most fascinating person I've ever talked to. That's crazy. And probably second on my list of the most fascinating people I've ever talked to was Nashawn Cook. And I had Nashawn on, he was episode 19, so he was kind of early on. And I'd read something that he'd posted on Facebook the week before. Someone had actually shared something that he posted on Facebook. And I thought, I got to get this guy on the podcast. I don't know anything about him, but I've got to have him on the podcast. And probably out of anybody's podcast, I think I've probably had the most feedback on Rupert Isaacs and on Nashawn Cook out of any of the podcasts. But right off the bat, like right at the very start of this thing, I asked, because I said to Nashawn, I don't really know much about you. What do you do? And he, right off the bat, he just spat this amazing little soliloquy out. And, you know, I'm going to play it now. But the thing is, there was so much. I mean, I could really listen to the whole lot of Nashawn's. He was just so wise, so well spoken. And for me personally, it kind of felt like, you know, like Rupert Isaacson was wise, like lived experience wise. Nashawn, it almost felt like he was downloading something from somewhere, like he was channeling information from somewhere. And I actually mentioned after I had him on the podcast to several people that, you know, I felt like I was witness to the Sermon on the Mound. But anyway, this small snippet here is from the very start of the podcast with Nashawn when I asked him what exactly he does.
Yeah, so I live in Parker, Colorado on my farm. We have a 10-acre little farm out here. And I basically do a lot of rehab work with horses, a lot of musculoskeletal stuff. I'm trained classically as a dressage rider. And so, but yeah, a lot of my work focuses on rehabilitation and, working around traumatic issues that horses and riders have. Yeah.
Horses and riders.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So like, are you doing like somatic stuff with riders?
Well, a lot of it is, so a lot of the work that I, I do with writers is based pretty heavily in mindfulness and Vipassana meditation.
Wow.
So, you know, and kind of the crux of the Vipassana work is, you know, breathing, basically, as I understand it, breathing into the spaces and finding, you know, kind of doing body scans and going where the breath isn't really reaching and breathing into that space and figuring out what emotions are hiding in that space. And so what I've pretty much found is that, you know, when riders are coming up on a trauma around riding, their body stops accepting the breath at a certain point. And that's usually where they're protecting, and consequently, it's where the horse finds the balance in their rider for resistance. And so if we can begin to work through, that stuck point, and it's usually, you know, it can be trauma, but sometimes it's just an untrue belief, then we can start really working on, you know, riding from a place of communication instead of riding thinking that control is necessary.
Wow. We are 3 minutes in and I've already got the price of admission already. That was kind of what I thought might come out of your mouth based on that, the thing that you wrote.
So Robin and I have both given you some of our highlights from the whole thing. So I think Tyler has got some that he'd like to share with you too. So we'll hand it over to Tyler for a minute and let him share his thoughts on some of his favorite moments from the podcast.
Hello everyone, it's Tyler. I'd just like to say thank you to everyone who has been a part of this podcast, anyone who's listened so far. I've edited every single one of the 66 podcasts. And it's been my ultimate pleasure to be able to share those stories and these experiences. And I think more than anything, these mindsets, tools, all of the with everyone. I think the people and the guests who have been on the podcast are amazing. They each have such unique outlooks on life, and they've all kind of arrived at a very similar conclusion, but through very different avenues. And I think that's really, really awesome. I've actually had the pleasure of meeting a couple of our podcast guests. The first one of those being Elsa Sinclair. Me and my father met her at Equidays in New Zealand in 2019, and she's just as good with people as she is with horses. She's very bubbly and just awesome. She's just a feel-good person to be around, and you can see why the horses like to be around her as well. She talked in this podcast piece about not being able to sit still, and it's kind of the antithesis of what my dad has been talking about with, you know, the meditations and the slowing down and the mindfulness. But I find, and Elsa finds as well, that we end up paying attention a lot, and our minds are always constantly racing. And I do find moments of calm and flow, but I find them in actions. So I teach people how to rock climb at a rock climbing gym here in Honolulu that just opened. And I love rock climbing. I like surfing. I like skiing. I like sailing. All of these things that you have to be very there for and present with. Often they're high risk, and that kind of elevates things to force you into that flow state. And all that flow state is paying attention and allowing your body to do things kind of naturally. And I think Elsa may get herself into a position where she's paying attention so purposefully, but it converts into this attention to detail that communicates with the horses and with the people that, you know, she cares and she's there for them. And that's really, really amazing. And I also, too, just can't really sit still and just meditate. And Elsa, in her podcast, mentions that she hates the word meditation, and she can't meditate. She can't sit still and do the thing. So I think both me and my mom actually pay attention on the far end of the scale. We pay attention very, very closely. So that's where I associate and I connect with Elsa. And in this piece where she talks about what she did with her horse in Taming Wild, where she trained a horse without any tools in an open field, what's required of you to be able to do that. So here's Elsa Sinclair.
So in order for you to do what you did,
in that year, most people couldn't have done that. So you must have been at a, what comes before that? Like, you didn't learn to be that present and that still right there and then, because it'd be like a 12-month sensory deprivation tank. You would lose your freaking mind. And so is there a story behind that? Like, how did you personally forget, come up with the idea of what you wanted to do? How did you actually mentally and physically do that? I mean, what's your background? You know, did you live in Tibet in a monastery for 6 years or something or other?
No, not at all. And I actually don't consider myself that good at being work. I feel like I have found a side door into it, and that is in paying attention. Most people can't just be because their stress goes up without something for their mind to chew on. And specifically, when there is not a busyness, the mind starts to chew on things that are stressful, problems that are unsolvable. And what I trained myself to do was to pay attention so closely that I was looking for the solvable problems. I was looking for the questions that could be answered. And if I couldn't find the questions that could be answered, I had to break it down again and pay more attention. What tiny details led me to the questions that I could answer, the problems I could solve? And so, in fact, I was very, very busy inside my mind. I was not just being. I'm terrible at just being. I'm not one of those people that could go in a sensory deprivation tank. I'm impressed you can. And I think it's wonderful and I think it's amazing, but it's not my strong suit. So my side door into being is to pay such deep attention that my mind is busy in ways that lower stress instead of raising stress. And that's in finding the solvable problems.
The next person that I decided to pull a piece of their conversation from was Jonathan Field. I've also had the pleasure of meeting Jonathan, and I think he, like many of the other podcast guests, are the type of person who makes you feel seen, feel felt, you know, the whole sense of getting gotten. And I think that's why they're so good with horses as well. I met Jonathan in Los Angeles at the Western States Horse Expo a couple years back, and we had dinner and had a good time. He's a character. He's a great storyteller and just a really great listener and awesome, all-around awesome guy. And in this piece, he talks about the power of visualization. And while I think I'm not very good at meditation, my dad has kind of shown me that, you know, we have the power to manifest things in our lives. And I think I owe a lot of, you know, my current lifestyle to that. It's because if I really want something and I really ask for it and I really believe that I'll get it, you know, it'll happen. And if we cast your memories back to the episode, How to Manifest a Car Crash, where my dad crashed the truck and bought the ticket to America and, you know, therefore I was born, he didn't realize that he was manifesting at that point in time. And I think I'm really lucky in the fact that I've been growing up around my dad and him talking about all the things that he talks about. I now understand that I am manifesting my life, and I understand that I can continue to do so. And so I think that's really powerful that I've been able to figure that stuff out now while I'm still young, and be able to have that for the rest of my life, which I'm really grateful for. In Jonathan's piece, yeah, he talks about visualization, the power of visualization. And he came back from a very traumatic incident when he was younger on an oil rig. And he talks a little bit about, you know, the power of his mind and positivity and the power of, I think a lot of it is commitment, right? Like, you have to set aside a certain amount of time. He talks about it, I don't think in this piece, but he was doing it for, you know, 2 or 3 hours each session, and he was doing multiple sessions throughout the day to just visualize himself. He hurt his hand really badly, and so he eventually regained feeling in his hand because he visualized the sense of feeling in his hand. And I think that's really, really powerful. As a climber, one of the world's strongest climbers, there's an amazing YouTube video. It's called Silence. It's about the hardest climb in the world. And half of the video is him laying on the floor, visualizing the sequence of moves. before he's not even on the ground. He's literally laying on his back, but he's yelling and screaming and he's in it. He's actually climbing the route, but he's doing it all visualization, and he wouldn't have been able to climb it if he had not practiced it that way. So I need to learn how to better institute that visualization in my mind for sure. But I think this little segment is a testament to the power of that. And I think with Jonathan and the work that he does with his Liberty horses, it's so crucial for him to be able to create that connection. And I think his horses feel and see the visualization that he emits, you know. It's a wavelength of thought that he's putting out there. So I think that's really awesome and possibly one of the secrets to success in the line of work that he does.
You know, this is like, I'm looking at a drilling rig crush me, or I'm looking at a scary thing happen to me. It was just like, you know, a feeling. You turn the lights on, it still wouldn't even go away. So I learned through with Annette and, you know, Dr. Bernie Siegel reading his books, and Dr. Wayne Dyer, and, you know, especially Dr. Bernie Siegel, when he talked about like how people could use the power of their mind to grow nerves and to get circulation and you know, create insulin in their body and, you know, whatever, all these things. And I just went into that meditative, you know, the style of meditation that is, you know, not to clear your mind and make your mind still, but more the Western style of meditation where you're going to focus on something. And so I would focus on circulation. I would focus on growing nerves. I'd focus on riding horses and seeing, and, you know, and I had seen Pat Pirelli play with a horse at Liberty on a video once. I'd never seen that. I imagined that my horses were coming to me, and I didn't have to rope them, and I could ride them and gallop them on the hills and with nothing on them. Like, I had this connection. I remember one of the big ones I used to visualize all the time was water skiing, you know, and I thought, I'll never be able to water ski because I'll never be able to have that pull on my wrist. And so I would visualize water skiing. And, you know, I visualized water skiing for hundreds of hours, you know, over the course of that 2 years at least, you know. And horses and everything else, whatever I was going to do. And whenever I'd get into that meditative state, and they say that nerves, like your brain communicates through your nervous system through vibration. And there's different vibrations. There's alpha, there's beta, there's different vibrational frequencies inside your body. And when you're in that alpha state, which is not awake, not in deep sleep, but right on that cuspal point where you're not quite awake, like in the morning or just before you sleep, but you're not quite asleep, you're not quite awake, you're not quite asleep, you're in this alpha state. And they say that that state is the highest vibrational, it's alpha state, which is the highest vibrational frequency for healing, recovery. And I couldn't get into that state and hold it very long because I'd either just fall asleep or I'd just be up in my head and awake and just too awake. But if I could get into there for a couple of minutes, I felt zero pain, zero. Like I was going from Tylenols and Tylenol 3 with codeine like every 2 hours, 24 hours a day, to when I could hold, when I went from that to like nothing, when I could hold that alpha state longer. So I would start, I'd have my hand, I'd lay down in the bed, my hand was above my heart on pillows, and we actually had this little speaker, and we put this little speaker beside my hand. It was a 5-inch speaker, and it would just go, it was a tape cassette in there. And the tape cassette, they said it was the alpha vibrational sound. And it wasn't a sound, it was the vibration of the speaker. It was more like that. So I would put my hand beside that speaker. I would bring myself down into the alpha state, that meditative state, and I would focus on water skiing, riding horses, or my nerves growing, or I learned what nerves looked like. I read the books. My mom and Angie got me all kinds of stuff, what tendons look like and, you know, that kind of thing. And so I spent hours and hours and hours. And Annette said to me, you know, I can't remember, it was exactly her, but, you know, if you can do this 15 minutes, 3 times a day, it will help. It'll help your state of mind. It'll help your healing, all this. Well, work. I ended up doing it for, you know, 2 hours, 3-4 times a day in the middle of the night, all of a sudden. And Angie, we were together, like we lived together there. She lived on the property and she would stay with me. She would have to sit there and listen to this, you know, in the bedroom. And, but I would sit there for hours like that. And whenever I was, it felt like my hand was normal. I had no pain, zero, no medication, nothing. And my nerves, from what they said, my nerves should have grown from way back in kind of one third of my arm, went all the way to the end of my fingers, which I can feel. They said there was no way they were going to go that far, especially in 96 when they took 1996 when they took nerves out of the back of my leg and put them in there with that microsurgery. And I believed I helped grow them. You know, whether I did or didn't, it was a way of me starting to take control of my life. And it wasn't, thank God for the amazing doctors and the nurses and, oh my gosh, like all the physio and the people that were involved. But this was a way of me also being a part of my healing.
So I hope you guys have been enjoying the podcast. I'm going to pass it back off to my dad. But again, I really appreciate everyone creating this space. And I really look forward to, I know my mom has only been the only one to mention it briefly in one of the previous episodes, the Journey On Podcast Summit next year, where we will hopefully have a lot of these, a large majority of the presenters all coming together in person, with conditions forbidding from COVID. But that will be really, really exciting. I will be there and I will help that event. There'll be more to come. I don't know how much I'm meant to actually say. So I'm going to pass it off to my dad again. Again, thank you guys so much for everything. It's been a blast.
Thanks, Tyler. You know, one of the other most fascinating guests I had on here was Shay Stewart. And there was so much about Shay on like a spiritual level and an energetic level. And she talked about a lot of amazing things. But probably the one thing I want to share of hers had to do with a horse training philosophy or a way of looking at horse training. And I just thought this was so fascinating, I had to share it with you. And these days, for me, yeah, it's more about the connection. And what I found is the things that I wanted them to do when I was working on obedience come so much easier when you've got the connection first.
Yes. Yes. And when I trained, when I had my place, I did things, you know, most trainers, they would have their groom or their assistant who would go get the horse, groom the horse, tack him up, and maybe do some groundwork, and then they'd hand the horse to the trainer to ride. For me, I would be the one. I had an assistant, but I would go get the horse, and when I got to their paddock, I would go, okay, is the horse softly approaching me, or is the horse, am I having to chase him around the paddock, and you know how they feel about being haltered. So I'd work on that. And then, okay, now that they're okay with this spot, how they feel about being led down the hill, and you know, are they rushing, are they pushing, are they trying to pull, you know, all these things. So I'd work on that. And then, okay, how they feel about being tied, and if there was an issue there, I'd work on that. And then I would get their saddle out and, okay, how's this going? Do I need to spend some time here? So by the time I got the horse, led them, tied them up, groomed them, put their tack on, maybe did a little bit of groundwork, I would then hand that horse to my assistant to go ride.
And that right there comes back to getting the basics good. You know, I mean, I started an Andalusian, a five-year-old Andalusian mare under saddle last year. And, you know, the first rides of her, I posted them on social media and people were like, wow, you know, you must be really good to get that to happen. Anybody could have done the first rides, you know. There was nothing going on there, you know. It's all the other stuff leading up to it. And you know, and like I said to Shay after she said that in most training situations, the least knowledgeable person on the place is the person that does everything up to the riding sort of a thing. And then, you know, and then you got to be a good horse trainer to fix the problems that these horses have. But yeah, I really had to share that because I thought that was, it's the, you know, the way I look at things, but I haven't really run across too many other people who have looked at things that way. And then I think the last thing I want to share with you guys is from the podcast I did with Gillian Kreinbring. And this conversation was actually about where she went to college, and she had told me about this amazing Catholic nun who had influenced her quite a bit And so, yeah, there's a little part of this that I think really ties in most of what we've talked about in the whole, all the episodes of the podcast.
Yeah, I went to a wonderful college. It was called Clark College. Now it's called Clark University. It used to be an all-woman school run by BVMs. And the nuns, when I went to school, still ran the school. And we were required to take two religion courses. This is a liberal arts school. And the nuns were so amazing because they were fed by the arts. Whether it was Sister Carol in the drama department, or Sister Carmel, the pottery nun, or Sister Marianne Zolman, which was the nun that I spoke of, who had the most piercing blue eyes of any person I've ever met. You could feel her presence in any room, not because it was a big authoritative presence, because it was omnipresent. It was love. It was compassion. It was empathy. It was insight. It was the greater good. And these strong, amazing women and their example actually made me even consider becoming a nun, not because of the Catholic teachings or trappings, but because of what they stood for in life. You know, they were women who educated themselves and gave to the community and explored art on a deep level. And Sister Marianne Zolman, she taught one of the required religious courses. It was called World Religions. And we learned about, you know, different Native American beliefs. It's not a monolithic religion, different belief systems within the different nations of Native Americans. We learned about Buddhism, Hinduism, all different kinds of religious perspectives. And I was always so intrigued by the subject matters, and I'd just ask all these different questions. And one day, Sister Marianne, in her way with those stunning blue eyes, just looked at me and she grabbed my hands and she said, "Sometimes, Jillian, we just have to bow before the mystery." Another pivotal moment. Because we as humans are always wanting to know why. We always want to have all the answers, and sometimes we just don't have all the answers. And what she gave me permission to feel was that it was okay not to know. But she didn't squash my curiosity. But that it's okay not to know, and it's okay to bow before that mystery. So she has a degree in, or a PhD in spirituality. And so these women were very influential into opening up a whole different way of looking at life. As a matter of fact, I gave a talk at a retreat once where I didn't find God or religion in a church, but I found it in nature. And for them to be so open and forward-thinking to allow me to structure my entire presentation on that without judgment gave me permission to keep expanding in whatever it is that you have interest in. Whatever your curiosity is, to give yourself permission to be curious and to experiment and not to be confined by dogma or not to be confined with harsh judgment. So, yes, I think back on them fondly and revisit some of the things that they taught me, because those things that they taught me certainly mean a different thing to me now than they did when I was 20 years old, you know. So, and she's an amazing, amazing human being.
So I think the whole podcast was full of amazing human beings, and, you know, some of the interesting stories they told, especially the woo-woo ones. I think, you know, in the words of that Catholic nun, sometimes we just have to bow before the mystery. And yeah, it's been fun sharing my explorations into some of that stuff. And so I just want to thank everybody who has listened to the podcast. You know, all of you guys have added up one by one to us getting a million downloads. And for that, we are very, very grateful and very humbled. It's apparently our podcast is in the, you know, the upper range, you know, in the top 1% of any or all podcasts. That's yeah, pretty amazing situation being. But thank you all. Thank you guys so much for listening to the podcast. And join us on the next episode when hopefully I have another fascinating guest.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.